which I'm Leonard Lopate. On October 18, 2013, Art Cohn, a California businessman, filed a civil suit in the U.S. District Court for Southern California as a class action on behalf of consumers throughout the United States who'd purchased services after January 1, 2007 that were known as live events from Trump University. The case, Art Cohn versus Donald J. Trump, resulted in the most expensive legal defeat of Donald Trump's career. Gatekeeper Press has published a book by Mr. Cohn and investigative journalist Dan Good called Trump U, Promises, Lies, and Corruption, My Battle with Donald Trump's Fake University. And it brings Mr. Cohn to our show now. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Can you hear me okay?
I hear you perfectly well.
Fantastic. Thank you for having me.
There's been a slew of books written about what happened during Donald Trump's years in the White House, but these events took place in the years before and during his run for the presidency. If you'd published it before the election, do you think that his loyal followers, or some of them anyway, might have had second thoughts?
You know, that's a great question. I'm not so sure, but I will tell you one thing, is that if we had the opportunity of a trial that was actually scheduled, which you'd learn in the book, in August of 2016, there was a scheduled trial. Unfortunately, that trial was postponed, and you'll learn in the book through a deposition, which, interestingly enough, today, of all things, Donald Trump is in another deposition.
A whole bunch of cases coming up.
I'm sorry?
There are a whole bunch of cases coming up right now.
There absolutely are. There are a lot of cases. But the deposition that I witnessed live on December 15th of 2015 foreshadowed a lot of the actions that Donald Trump did that enabled the trial to be postponed. Hmm. And when that trial was postponed till after the election, I think that might have had an impact on the election, much more so than actual any book that anyone might have written. So that is really one of the things that many readers will get out of the book, is learning about this potential trial and how this trial got delayed and how it was the order was delayed. And look, in May of 2016, Trump's attorneys went before the court, and it is they who argued that he didn't have time for a trial in August because that would interfere with his campaign. He wouldn't be able to go around to do speeches and so forth. So it is their argument that that was the reason why they wanted it delayed. Now, at the end of the day, they argued that the reason for the delay was because it would be a circus and that it would be difficult to get a fair jury. But it doesn't make a whole lot of sense, right, Leonard? I mean, common sense says, hey, you think it'll be easier to find a jury after an election, whether win or lose?
Well, he did settle. So and we'll
yes,
get to
he
that.
Did. Yes,
let's,
we will. Yeah.
Let's go back to the beginning. What were you doing
at
the time in 2009 that you decided to enroll in Trump University?
Well, you know, it was a difficult time for me. I was in between jobs. Living out in Silicon Valley. I had a startup company that I had started up in 2004, and I was CEO. And it's quite common that sometimes the CEO actually gets pushed out by the major investors, which had happened to me.
So
in 2009, I was sitting there without a job, and I was thinking, okay, the economy, people don't remember, but in 2008, 2009, especially in the consumer electronics industry, the market wasn't so hot. Companies like Circuit City were going out of business and others. It was a tough time, and that's the business that we were in. And so I was in a situation where I was looking for something new, and I saw this advertisement and opportunity. Donald Trump was someone, and I'm from the Philadelphia area originally, so I've seen Trump's, I've heard of Trump and at that time, and and certainly knew of his, you know, what I thought were tremendous real estate successes. So quite frankly, I was a fan of Trump. Why else would I invest more than $40,000 in Trump University? I thought this was, you know, a great opportunity to get new to get special deals through access to Trump's network.
So you also received a special invitation. They saw you as one of their potential students. But Trump was probably best known at the time as a reality TV star. What was he promising to provide with Trump U? Didn't he say, well, I could turn anyone into a successful real estate investor, including you?
Yes, it was. That is correct. I mean, and he also claimed that he was bringing this university would have the best professors, the best people. What does that sound like before he, it foreshadowed a lot of what he said and had done when he became president as well in his presidential campaign. He promised the best people and so forth. So, yeah, people got snookered, but out of tens of thousands of dollars. And he really preyed on not only on people like myself, but also on people that were elderly. And so a lot of people who we eventually settled, as we mentioned before, which we'll get into detail later. But a lot of those people, even with the settlement, it took many years for the money to be dispersed. Some of those people passed.
And many people didn't, and nobody got the full amount, right? 90%.
They got close to the full amount. We were able to settle for about 90 cents on the dollar. But what they did get back was their time, their aggravation, their waiting, maybe the credit interest that they put on their credit card bills, and then a lot of miscellaneous incidentals that, you know, we couldn't claim to receive a class action status. Things like other miscellaneous fees, setting up a corporation, which they advise that you do, and so forth and so on. It became a litany of different fees.
Now, what was the initial tuition? Both you and your wife registered.
That's right. Well, at first they bring you to what's a quote free seminar that you're supposed, you know, and at that seminar, it's a sales pitch. And the first sales pitch is about $1,500 program. And then after that, at that program, you thought you're going to learn something, but then you find out, well, you really can't do this without being in, you know, without having a mentor to guide you through the program. And it's a hard sale, but it was convincing. And at that point, you're laying out another $35,000 some dollars. So you're into it now for $38,000-$39,000 at that point. And you don't have much recourse on getting your money back to find out whether it's any good before you actually meet this so-called mentor that was supposed to be an expert, which I later explained in the book was far from it.
Were you told that Trump was going to do any of the teaching, or is it all supposed to be through the mentors?
You were told that the mentors claimed that they had connections with Donald Trump, that they knew Donald Trump, that they could get you connected to Donald Trump, that they could get you access to properties that he was selling in New York City on buildings ahead of time so that you would get discounted properties that you could quickly flip, things like this. They also said that from time to time, Donald Trump might come to one of the quote university seminars. But that never happened. But these were just all part of the marketing and promotion.
And the seminars were held in hotel ballrooms, not in classrooms?
That is correct, yes.
So didn't that make you a little suspicious? Or did you think, well, gee, this is a different kind of university?
Well, there was a different kind of university. And also, look, a lot of people take classes remote online. And also at the time, I had just gotten through my MBA program through San Jose State University. Well, I I'm dating myself here, but I graduated in 92. And in that program, I did not go on campus except for one class. All my classes were taken in rooms. At the time, I was working for Apple Computer, so they were taken in rooms at Apple's locations. So it wasn't unusual to think that a university could use other locations for classroom teaching. It was more about who the quote professors were being claimed to be and their credentials.
Now, okay, so you have these classes in hotel ballrooms, but were you learning anything? Did the classes feature any of Donald Trump's real secrets?
No, not at the end of the day. They were really pitches to get into the major dollars they wanted you to spend, which was with a mentor.
More than the $35,000 and $40,000 that you already were spent had already spent.
Well, at that point, once you spent that $35,000+, I had to wait about 2 or 3 months before I actually met with this mentor. And then that mentor was going to walk through deals with you and explain to you what you were doing, how you were doing it, and so forth and so on. But that was an unfortunate best word. It was somewhat of almost like a joke.
So is that when you started being to feel that you'd been scammed?
That's correct. At that point, because before that, I'm setting up an LLC for potential real estate investment. I was getting phone calls and being possibly introduced to real estate brokers and so forth. Once I met with the mentor who is trying to give me advice to go to Home Depot to pick up materials to fix up a home and things like that, and who I later find out had very, very little transactional experience in real estate itself, then I realized that I had been scammed, and I at that point realized there was not much I could do to recover the funds.
Did you do this before the Better Business Bureau gave Trump you a D rating?
That's correct. Yeah, this was in 2009. I believe that that D minus rating came sometime after that.
And didn't Mother Jones magazine reveal a conversation that was caught on a hot mic video? What did it reveal?
Well, that hot mic video is, you know, I delivered that to Mother Jones.
And so how did you get it?
I was watching the deposition. So as lead plaintiff, so we're jumping around here a little bit, but that's okay. In 2010, I 2009, I realized I had gotten scammed, and then I moved on. I started up another business and just moved on. But at that point in 2010, I learned about another lawsuit that was being filed by a woman by the name of Tarla Makoff. And Tarla Makoff, she filed a lawsuit in 2010 against Trump University. And I thought, I'm not the only one here that got scammed. Because, you know, quite frankly, it's embarrassing to think that you could fool for this and so forth and so on. But I did. And I called the attorneys that were involved in that case, and they got back to me and said, would you like us to represent you? And I said, absolutely. And I explained to them my case. I provided them the paperwork and so forth. And I stuck with them for a number of years. And at some point they came to me and they said, look, you know, we could really use your help in representing all the students, because it turned out that the Tarla Makoff case only represented Florida, New York, and California. And primarily, one of the causes of action in that case had to do with elder law. They couldn't file a national case because different states had different rules and the statutes weren't the same. And this was being filed in federal court. So at the end of the day, we filed a RICO, a racketeering influence and corrupt organizations complaint against Donald Trump himself. So we filed a second, and I was lead plaintiff in that suit.
In 2013.
There were multiple suits. And right before that, in New York, the attorney general at the time, Eric Schneiderman, and his assistant attorney general, Tristan Snell, had filed a lawsuit in New York, filing of a suit. So now there are three lawsuits going on at the same time.
I'm speaking with the lead on one of those lawsuits, perhaps the one that got the most attention, Art Cohen, who has written with the help of Dan Good, Trump U, Promises, Lies, and Corruption, My Battle with Donald Trump's Fake University. It is published by Gatekeeper. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Streaming live at WBAI.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So what did Trump reveal in that hot mic video?
So in that hot mic video, which was stunning at the time when I was watching it, so what led up to it is we're in the middle of a deposition, which I was watching remotely from my home in California, attorneys remotely. And that's through texting as well as email, asking different questions and saying, well, why don't we ask this question and that question? Then there's a break, as there normally is in depositions. And I don't know, a lot of people haven't gone through depositions, but I explain my deposition, my personal deposition being deposed in the book itself. And this deposition was not going on like a normal deposition. By the way, I apologize for the beeping in the background. I can't control that on my computer. I've been trying to undo that, so I apologize for that beeping. And in any case, what I heard in that break was Donald Trump talking to his attorney with other people in the room, but apparently the mic was hot, so they might have been talking quietly, but nonetheless, I could hear it remotely, not knowing that I was still live on the camera. And I'm listening to him talk about how he wanted to have his attorney talk to the judge about something about him, because maybe, boom, it'll all go away. Now, I'm thinking, wait a minute, what does that mean? And then he starts talking about the Spanish thing, whatever that means. We later learned what that meant, right? I mean, yeah. He attacked the judge in public about being Spanish or Hispanic
or Mexican.
He
said
be a fair judge
he
Coriel,
said he said he was a hater. He described as Spanish or Mexican, although Judge Curiel was born in Indiana. His parents had been Mexican immigrants, but he was a native born American.
Yes he was
a bit calling on the race card in effect here.
Yes. So he had planned that race card was being planned as early as December. This deposition was December 2015, when already Trump was thinking about the race card and how to use that against Judge Coriel. So it was well planned. And later you learn through the deposition and the hot mic moment. A lot of people think, oh, Donald Trump doesn't understand the law, he's just a businessman and so forth. No, he understood exactly what was going on. And he reveals that in that hot mic moment. And I encourage people to watch that video online. I mean, it's out there. But the full transcript, it's difficult to hear some parts of it. The full transcript is in the book. I provide that a detailed transcript of what was said there. There were other things said there, too. If you remember that during the campaign at that time, he said that the university never got a D grade. It was an A. And Marco Rubio was up there attacking him over that. And so, I mean, that was a very interesting time. But this tape reveals that in there he says, do you remember we got a D and I got that thing changed to an A? Do you know how we got it changed to an A? Through extortion. He had one of his internal attorneys call the Better Business Bureau, and this is his own words, and told them to change it from a D to an A. And if they didn't do that, he was going to sue the hell out of them.
He got Marco Rubio to change as well.
He did, didn't he?
Now,
he did.
These events, go ahead, finish what you're going to say.
Well, those things were some of the two key elements. There's other things that were going on that went on in that hot mic, but those two things were quite damning. One, him admitting that he extorted the Better Business Bureau to change the grade, and two, he was plotting to talk to the judge about something about him. To this day, I don't know, and I ask. You know, we're on public radio here, and if he's listening, which I doubt because he's probably in a deposition now, but he'll listen later. You know, what did that thing about him, about the judge, what was he threatening, you know, or thinking to threaten the judge about that? But what we do know are the actions that he did do in public, which is he did go out there and make a speech and attack the judge and call him a hater and so forth. And consequently, the judge, through my attorneys, told me that he had gotten many death threats.
Well, he suggested that someone ought to look into the judge, which alarmed legal experts concerned about their impact on judicial independence. Then later that June, he issued a lengthy statement saying that his criticism of the judge had been misconstrued and that his concerns about Curiel's impartiality were not based upon ethnicity alone, but also upon rulings in the case.
Right. But that really wasn't true. I mean, there were many rulings that he got in his favor during the case. And there were small rulings and so forth. And Trump misuses our justice system in a way of finding ways to delay what ultimately is the inevitable. Okay, and that's why he ultimately had to settle. But he found ways to delay it. And I'll give you a really one example, but there were so many, is that we would put forward certain expert witnesses that, you know, and we were ready to go to trial. We even had mock trials in June, July timeframe of 2016. We were ready to go in August until it got delayed. But that delay to this day is uncertain about why it was truly delayed, because knowing what we heard in the hot mic, was the judge influenced in some other way to move the date other than, well, he's going to be campaigning, or it's going to be a circus, or so forth and so on. So I really do hope that someday we find out the true reason why that trial was delayed, because that one decision in May of 2016 literally changed American history and democracy potential.
Now,
in the way things are now,
you say even during the trial you believe that Trump would do what was right and settle. These events gave you a private view of him during the height of the presidential campaign. As someone who had admired him, what was your take during those proceedings?
Well, you know, there were points in time where I met Donald Trump in the courtroom and we were going through a mediation. And this was earlier on where I thought, okay, you know, maybe it's possible that he didn't know that these people around him were running the university and they were just doing bad things and, you know, and it was beyond his control and he was busy with other things. So maybe it was something like that. So 25 or it was, well, roughly $40 million is what they what they collected in revenue from the Trump University students. And I thought to myself, why don't you just return? You know, he's a billionaire. I wanted to go to him, walk up to him, and then I couldn't because of the court proceedings. But I really wanted to go up to him, and I talk about this in the book as well, where I simply wanted to say to him, just return the money. Say it was a mistake. You'll look like a hero. $40 million to a multi-billionaire, as he claimed to be, would be peanuts, right? And then he also could have said that, look, it wasn't, you know, this was something that he could have blamed it on Michael Saxton, who was the president or the day-to-day operations guy he claimed was running the organization and so forth. But no, he didn't want to do that. He one time made a very crazy offer, which was he made an offer to give us hotel vouchers in place of the money that was lost to students.
That would have been a lot of hotel vouchers. You say you spent as much as $40,000?
Yes. And there are some students who spent more. There was one, Tarla Makoff, who filed her case in 2010 in her class action suit. She filed, I think she lost over $70,000. She invested over $70,000.
You say you weren't interested in politics when these events began. Was this experience one of the reasons you became an alternate delegate for Hillary Clinton in the 2016 Democratic National Convention?
Yes. And a lot of people make this about Democrat, Republican. The reality of it was Donald Trump was a Republican in 2009. I mean, excuse me, he was a Democrat. He was a Democrat in 2009.
Registered
Democrat. But he had certain views from time to time that were certainly more progressive than where he ultimately ended up being. So, I mean, the reality of it is he's neither a Democrat or a Republican. He's a he's just for himself.
He took a full page ad out in the New York Times calling for the death penalty for the Central Park Five who had been accused of a rape that they hadn't committed. DNA evidence eventually exonerated them. But that was pretty extreme at the time,
yes,
calling for the death penalty. Well, anyway, you became an alternate delegate for Hillary Clinton during the Democratic National Convention, then became president of the Silicon Valley Democratic Club. So this really moved you into taking political position.
Yes, it certainly did, because I did believe during that time, and still do, that he's a threat to our democracy as we know it. He doesn't believe in the rule of law. He is willing, and that goes to what's going on today. We have a situation now where he's being accused of numerous crimes, and he's using the court system to delay to avoid potential outcomes that may prevent him from running in 2024. Because I do believe he will run in 2024, and I believe that many people with much greater connections than I have do know that he's going to run in 2024. Mm-hmm. He's just, you know, he needs that attention. He needs to be in the news in that particular way. And we have, I believe, the Manhattan DA investigating him, correct? And also there's a case in Georgia investigating him. But with regards to the Manhattan DA, let me divert. There's something in my book, and it's actually on page 76. And I'm to get it right, I'm going to read directly from my book here. And it says, there was a deposition held with another deposition that we held with a gentleman by the name of Alan Weisselberg. I'm sure you know who Alan Weisselberg is, right?
Sure. In fact, he's been indicted.
That is correct. And everybody talks about, will he flip on Trump? It turns out that we deposed Alan Alan Weisselberg in 2015, in June 2015. And in my book, I will read you a part of that deposition, which that deposition is, the full deposition is not publicly available. In any case, it says here, my attorney, Jason Forge, asked, throughout the time you were overseeing these things at Trump University, as with all other of Mr. Trump's investments, you were acting on Mr. Trump's behalf, correct? That's what my attorney asked. And Mr. Weisselberg said, yes, of course. And then my attorney followed up. And you were ultimately, you were subject to his ultimate control. And he answered, yes. Now, why is that important? That is important, I believe, and I hope that the Manhattan DA is either listening or already has this information and has this deposition. But it shows that Alan Weisselberg took direct control over all financial matters, investment matters from Donald Trump. So this is not a guy who's just going off and cheating on taxes, as the indictment is claiming recently. He's taking instructions, anything that's with financial matters, directly from Trump. And he said that under oath and in a deposition in 2015, June 2015.
This is Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, streaming live at WBAI.org. Back with Art Cohn, who has written with the help of investigative journalist Dan Good a book called Trump U, Promises, Lies, and Corruption, My Battle with Donald Trump's Fake University, published by Gatekeeper Press. That song could have been written by you.
Yeah.
The suit, as you mentioned earlier, alleged violations of the RICO statute is essentially a scheme to defraud and accuse Trump of misrepresenting Trump University to make tens of millions of dollars while actually delivering neither Trump nor a university. Do you think that's what Trump really had in mind all along? He must have, if that's the case, he must have known that eventually it was going to backfire.
It's hard to know what he had in mind. If you know. In the actual deposition, there's a part in his actual deposition where he claims that he has the greatest memory in the world. Yet, when they ask him questions about his involvement in the actual university itself, he says, "I don't recall. Too many years. I don't recall. I don't recall. I don't recall every name, every person that was involved in the organization." He just didn't recall. So my take on it, it would be, is that Trump University, like Trump Wine or some other thing, was just a mechanism to make a buck. He wasn't really interested in putting together a program to help people. And when you put together a university like that, you would think that you're putting together something to help people.
The suit named Trump as the sole defendant and sought restitution as well as damages, including punitive and treble damages, which suggests that there was going to be a long time spent in the courts.
Yes. And it would have been. So settlement, I had a fiduciary responsibility. And a lot of people might ask, reading the book, well, you'll learn reading the book why, but might even be your listeners may be asking, well, why didn't this guy talk about this in 2016? Why didn't he come out and talk about it? Well, and talk about this tape that he had and so forth? Well, I had a fiduciary responsibility to the 6,000 plus students that had gotten ripped off. And my duty was to recover as much dollars representing those students as possible. And to do it as quickly as possible, because keep in mind, many of them were elderly and may have not been around, and some weren't around ultimately when we did get the funds. And even though we settled in 2016, we had an appeal that was through one student, Simpson, and then that appeal lasted some time, and funds didn't get distributed until April of 2018. That was the bulk of the funds, but then there was another disbursement in January of 2019. And it was at that point that I felt that now it was time to potentially get this story out there. So I started thinking about it, and I filed a report, which you'll learn in the book, with the California Department of Justice with regards to the hot mic tape, which, remember, at that point in time was not in the public domain in any way, shape or form. It was only until I released it to Mother Jones in August 2020. So in 2019 was a pivotal year for me, in which I talked a lot in the book about how I try to get this story out. And that included everything from talking to Adam Schiff to talking to Zoe Lufrin, Anna Eshoo. These are all representatives on the West Coast in my area. And going through that process of talking with them, and during the first impeachment, providing the tape to the investigative team, Daniel Goldman's team, Adam Schiff's team, with regards to the first impeachment. It turns out that they did not attempt to impeach for obstruction of justice or conspiracy to obstruct justice, which is what I believe that tape shows. Yeah. That when you know at that point in time when he said, talk to him about that thing about him and maybe this will all go away, that was a conspiracy to obstruct justice, to influence a federal judge to throw out a case through some sort of indecent persuasion, whatever that was.
Well, going all the way back to October 24th, 2014, Judge Curiel ruled that you had presented enough evidence to allow the case to proceed. But Alan Garten, the Trump Organization general counsel, said Trump University would appeal that ruling, which he said showed a manifest disregard for the law. And he also said Trump would ask Curiel to recuse himself because of his animosity toward Mr. Trump and his views. But Trump lawyers never filed any motion to recuse. And according to legal experts, such a motion would lack legal merit and possibly be considered frivolous.
That is correct.
This is dragging on a long time.
Yes, it was. And this case was the longest case on Judge Curiel's docket. So here he is, you know, with many cases. And that's why the postponement of the trial was such a big deal. And by the way, we had multiple bites at the apple. And what I mean by that is the first trial was going to be the Makoff case. And we were already doing mock juries on that to see how it would go. If for whatever reason we had a hung jury or whatnot, my trial, the RICO case, would follow right behind the August 2016 case. And of course, there could have been appeals on both sides. At the end of the day, the settlement was the right thing for the students, for all of us, because Trump most likely would have appealed any decision. And as we all know, that takes a lot of time through the courts.
And he would have been president.
And he would have been president, and it would have been very, very difficult to move the case forward with him as president of the United States.
Well, Curiel set the trial on the suit to begin November 28, 2016, after the presidential election, with jury selection several weeks earlier.
Yes.
And in August of that year, the district court had denied Trump's motion for summary judgment, ruling that there was sufficient evidence against him for the case to go to jury.
Yes.
So then Trump requested a delay of the trial until after the inauguration?
That's correct. He wanted to delay it again. I think it was till February of 2017. But that would have been even more difficult, right? Because now you're dealing with a sitting president. In November 28, he was not a sitting president. He was president at that time elect. So there was a big difference between a president sitting, you know, to be deposed and so forth. But Trump had already accomplished what he wanted to accomplish by November 28th, which was delaying the trial, delaying exposing his fraud and his financial affairs that all would have come out in that trial.
You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. My guest is Art Cohn, who with investigative journalist Dan Good has written Trump U, Promises, Lies, and Corruption, My Battle with Donald Trump's Fake University. Well, an awful lot of requests were made for the release of information. In May of 2016, Judge Curiel granted a request by the Washington Post for public release of certain documents that had been filed in the case. What did they reveal include, since they included playbooks with instructions for employees to use a hard sell approach, as well as depositions in which former employees said that Trump University had defrauded or lied to its students?
Yeah, those documents, what was called the playbook, those documents revealed very clearly that the scheme from the beginning was a fraud. So the people that they hired that were so-called professors were not professors, were sales guys. And their job was just to get people to sign on, and then to sign on to the next class, and to the sign on to the next seminar, and so forth and so on.
Do you think there was ever any plan to actually reveal any information or teach anything?
Anything that was revealed could have been picked up online, pretty much. It was just a pretty packaging of PowerPoints, quite frankly. That's what it was. So there was no real Trump secret information in fact, it was somewhat just the opposite. They had given some advice to me and I ran into some trouble. This is when I realized things were really going downhill. I was given some advice, and then I was trying to work with some real estate agents, and they said they couldn't do what the advice they were giving me. Because they said it's illegal in California. You can't do that. And so some of the things not only were fluff or could just be, you know, found online, some of them were just blatantly not legal, not legally able to be done in the state of California. Now, I don't know about other states, but that was what my experience was.
You mentioned the videotapes of Trump's two depositions in your case that were taken in November 2015 and January 2016. The Washington Post was denied, and other media organizations denied their release, but hadn't transcripts of those depositions already been released showing, quote, that Trump repeatedly indicated that he had never met instructors at Trump University, despite advertisements for the program indicating that its staff had been handpicked by the real estate mogul?
Yes, yes, that's true. The actual written depositions. But have you ever tried reading have you ever read a deposition?
No, luckily.
Well, I tell
not
you,
into
it's
not into your book.
It's not something that people like to read. It's not easy reading. It's voluminous. It's I mean, I have one transcript in here, the hot mic moment, but I do not have in my book. My book's not a legal book, right? In that respect. So it's not, you don't have to be a lawyer to understand my story in this respect. But yeah, that information was out there, but there was a lot of other things going on, and the judge's ruling not to release the video was because he thought there was going to be a jury trial and that could affect potential jurors and so forth and so on. Because the videos of the actual deposition would have certainly been brought up in the trial itself, especially if there were discrepancies when Trump would take the stand. So the release that of just the transcripts, the written transcripts, for a lack of a better word, were probably just too dull. And yes, the information was there, probably didn't grab the attention of the public at the time.
But wouldn't they have been rather damning? Because as I mentioned, he admitted that he'd never met instructors at Trump University, despite the advertisements that indicated the staff had been handpicked by him. So that was I don't know if truth in advertising is a punishable offense or mistruth in advertising, but that would have been pretty damaging, wouldn't it? If it had gone,
yes,
to trial?
It was. It was damaging, and it went towards the allegations of fraud in the case.
So what was the end result? He decided to settle. And what was the agreement?
The agreement was for we agreed on an amount of $25 million. Of that $25 million, $4 million of it went to New York. Mm-hmm. $1 million of it was in fines for using the Trump University name, as I understand it. And
it's assessed by the state of New York, the fines, for running an unlicensed university.
Correct. That is correct. Yes. And then, the other $3 or $4 million were to students, I believe, in New York that had been cheated and scammed by the Trump University program. The other $21 million went to all other students throughout the nation. Now, one of the reasons, and I must give tremendous credit to the attorneys Jason Forge, Rachel Jensen, Amber Eck. And there were two law firms. Amber Eck was in one of the smaller law firms that got the case started. And then Robin Gellers and Dodd was the larger law firm where Jason Forge and Rachel Jensen, who were the two lead attorneys on the case, they were from that firm. And they had all made a decision that for us to accept this settlement, that they would not take a penny.
So now, they forewent their fees and worked pro bono?
That is correct.
So that the 7,000 former Trump University students would receive all the money that was dispersed?
That is correct. So I had expressed that we – at a minimum settlement needed to be at least 50 cents on the dollar. I said, we cannot accept a penny less than that. they came back and said, we're not going to take any fees and or costs. Remember, there's not just their time, but all the cost in the investigation and the filing fees. They added up tremendously. They did not take a penny. And because of that, we were able to get closer to 90 cents on the dollar refund to all the students.
Didn't the settlement also specify that Trump didn't have to admit to any wrongdoing?
That is correct. And that's unfortunately what brought about the appeal in a sense from the Simpson case, because she really wanted Trump to apologize. In fact, Eric Schneiderman, which you'll learn in the book, he also almost blew the case up because he wanted blew the settlement up, if you will. He wanted Trump to also state in there that he would never start up another university again. We couldn't get that into the settlement agreement. So what we focused on again was getting the money to the students and getting the money out. So yes, as with many settlement agreements, and usually settlement agreements are private. In this particular case, this was a public settlement agreement. It's a class action lawsuit. So we all get to see it. But those who are not familiar with it, usually settlement agreements, the person that who did the wrongdoing, we usually have language in there that will say that they didn't admit to anything wrong.
He also didn't pay for it out of his own pocket. The settlement was actually paid by his Las Vegas hotel business partner, a billionaire named Phil Ruffin. And he said that he settled for a small fraction of the potential award because he was too busy as president-elect to take it to trial. He said, the only bad thing about winning the presidency is that I did not have the time to go through a long but winning trial on Trump U. Too bad. Now, I've pretty much run out of time, but I do want to ask you one more question about yourself. Other than writing this book, what have you been doing in the years since the case was settled?
Well, I
you ever get into real estate?
Except for buying my own home, no. No, I had not. And maybe in some ways, given what we've all seen real estate in New York and California do, it's probably clearly a good investment in that respect. My day jobs is more related to intellectual property and licensing and things of that nature. Yes.
Art Cohen and investigative journalist Dan Good have written Trump U, Promises, Lies, and Corruption, My Battle with Donald Trump's Fake University, published by Gatekeeper Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate the time and the questions, and I enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. If you'd like to hear more of our one-hour in-depth interviews, you can access our over 500 past shows at WBAI.org. We're also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, everywhere else that podcasts are available. And there are links to those past shows at LeonardLopateAtLarge.com. If you'd like to write to me, my email address is LeonardLopate@WBAI.org. Before I sign off today, I need to take just a minute to ask you to support the station. We are asking all of our listeners who have the means to do so to step up right now and make a contribution at whatever level they're comfortable with by going online to give to WBAI.org or by calling 212-209-2950 to keep this show coming to you weekdays from 1 to 2 p.m. That's 212-209-2950. Like most of the public radio stations across the country, WBAI has faced serious financial challenges because of the pandemic, and a lot of our suddenly strapped longtime supporters have had to drop their support, which is why we are asking anyone who is able to in this time of crisis to step up and make a contribution of any amount to help keep community radio and Leonard Lopate at Large on the air and coming to you weekdays from 1 to 2 p.m. because our only source of financial support is our listeners. The way to do that again is to call 212-209-2950 right now or go online to give to WBAI.org. Becoming a sustaining member of the station, what we call a BAI buddy, is a particularly great way to support us without having to shell out a lot of money at any one time, $20, $50. Whatever amount you feel comfortable with on a monthly basis until you decide you don't want to do it anymore. So, again, the number one more time, become a member at any amount. Call 212-209-2950. Go online to give to WBAI.org. And to everyone who's already supporting the station, in the name of Leonard Lopate at large, at whatever level you're doing it, thank you. And I hope you can join us again tomorrow when today Pam Allen will discuss a new edition of Reluctant Reformers, Racism and Social Reform Movements in the United States, a book that she co-authored with Robert Allen. She'll be joined by Stephen Hyatt, the book's editor. We'll see you then.
For WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Askia Muhammad. Here's some headlines. Colin Powell, the first black Secretary of State and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, died this morning from complications from COVID-19. He was 84. Born in New York to Jamaican immigrants, Powell served two tours in Vietnam and rose through the ranks to become Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in 1989. During his tenure as chairman, Powell oversaw Operation Desert Storm in 1991. While Secretary of State, he went before the United Nations to argue the U.S. case for the Iraq War, utilizing faulty information on Saddam Hussein hiding away weapons of mass destruction. In its statement, the Powell family said, "We want to thank the medical staff at Walter Reed National Medical Center for their caring treatment. We have lost a remarkable and loving husband, father, grandfather, and great American." A trial of three white men accused of murdering Ahmaud Arbery, a black man in Georgia, in February 2020, is set to begin with jury selection starting today. Arbery was shot and killed while jogging in Brunswick, Georgia. He was 25. For almost 2 months, there were no arrests in the case until a graphic video of the shooting leaked on social media. The three men accused in his killing, Greg McMichael, Travis McMichael, and William Bryan, contend they had reason to believe Arbery was responsible for home break-ins in the area and was shot as he tried to resist what they called a legal citizen's arrest. Jury selection could take up to 2 weeks because of the large jury pool. 600 potential jurors are expected to show up today at a South Georgia courthouse. Student protesters in the hashtag Blackburn Takeover have received support from various Howard University departments, faculty groups, and graduate programs as their protest continues, the Hilltop reports today. Howard School of Law students attended the ongoing protest as legal observers. Their goal was to protect protesters' rights and prepare them for encounters with law enforcement. Former President Donald Trump will sit for a video deposition today in a case involving an alleged assault during a 2015 demonstration outside of Trump Tower. The demonstration was in response to negative comments Trump made about Mexico and Mexican immigrants. Six protesters of Mexican descent said they were assaulted and sued Trump, the Trump Organization, his presidential campaign, and security personnel. Lawyers for the plaintiffs have argued that Trump should have known that security personnel would act in a negligent or reckless manner. Last month, State Supreme Court Judge Doris Gonzalez of the Bronx denied an effort by Trump to quash a subpoena ordering him to testify. The judge said Trump's argument that there must be exceptional circumstances to depose a high-ranking government official did not apply because he was being called to answer for conduct outside of office. Congress is back this week for a showdown over President Biden's infrastructure bill and the Build Back Better Act. Democrats are still trying to decide how to bring down the cost of the $3.5 trillion spending bill. The sweeping package aims to expand the nation's social safety net and combat climate change.